coming to our annual RICS University of Oxford Sustainable Urban Development lecture. I'm really delighted this evening to introduce to you Professor Danny Dorling. I'm sure you all know who Danny Dorling is. Danny grew up in Oxford and then returned to Oxford as a Halford Mackinder Chair Professor in Human Geography in the School of Geography and Environment at the University of Oxford. Danny's work, as I'm sure you will know, is concerned with inequalities, the inequalities in health, in education, in income, wealth, and housing. And Danny asked me to mention that he's recently published a series of articles about what the UK might look like 100 years in the future in Strike magazine, so please check those out. And I'll just hand over to Danny now. Thank you.
Thank you ever so much for coming and for the invite to this lecture. I need to start off by saying that I don't normally have a silly platter like this under my nose. And I am very grateful the lecture's not being videoed. But the reason I have this platter under my nose is that I managed to fall over in my bathroom at 2 o'clock this morning. And to a cup which I couldn't deal with myself, so I got myself to the John Radcliffe A&E. Unfortunately, I have not been drinking. If I had been drinking, they would have patched me up and discharged me within 2 hours and sent me home. But because I hadn't been drinking, they wanted to try to work out why I had fallen over. The end result is I'm now very happy with my blood pressure, my heartbeat, and I spent 10 hours in A&E today, and I'm feeling much happy about myself. I didn't waste my time then. John Radcliffe is in Oxford. Every nurse and porter and doctor I saw, I asked them where they were living and how much they were paying in rent. And the thing which shocked me, I hadn't expected this, was not one of them was living in Oxford. Not one. They were living in a town 20, 30 miles away. They were all renting. And they all said it's temporary. Some said they were trying to save up a 5% deposit, but they really thought they were going to go north. They said a few of the older staff had bought some time ago, but it was turnover city. That's what the Oxford Teaching Hospitals Trusts are. You do your 6 months, you get it on your CV, but and then you go off somewhere else. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, having a lot of young, enthusiastic staff. Many not from the UK, by the way, which is going to be interesting in the future. But it is a problem when the porter wheels you into the section for people who are not going to make it through the day. And I got slightly worried at that point. And then it turns out he was new, and I got wheeled out of that section. And that was good. And I watched the electrician came, hospital electrician, and asked where the cafe was, because he'd never been there before. And I watched people after people who were new asking questions that they only had to ask because they were new, and people planning to leave. And how on earth do you run this hospital? How do you keep running it? And of course, the demand is going to rise in future as the population ages, and people may begin to work out that they're going to get a job anyway, whether they get that on their CV or not. It's even more dire in London. And so, although I'm going to concentrate lots in this lecture, in some ways I'm really talking about London, it's just I do not know London as well as I know Oxford. I know that in the heart of London, a third of midwives are EU but not UK or Irish citizens. One third. There are lots and lots of issues. For those of you who like reading rather than listening, you would have read about William Morris. William Morris is famous for cars, for gambling bikes. His first bike shop was in 1870. And he was born in 1870, sorry. His first bike shop was just on Cali Road on James Street. Bikes, next year we'll have their 200th anniversary, basic two-wheeled bicycle. And the reason I'm going to largely talk about bikes is you can think about how you might provide the housing for the staff of John Radcliffe and the staff of all our schools, where the average Oxford school has a turnover of a quarter of staff each year, and the people who enter the bins. and the associate professors at the university, many of whom leave after 3 to 6 years because they get sick of paying rent. In fact, everybody. You have to worry about housing everybody. You can't decide that one set of people are key workers. You can work out how to provide more housing, and I'll talk about that later. But if you do provide more housing, you cannot get people around by car, or necessarily even by bus, because the roads are already full. Some census stuff and some data before I give you my ideas. This is an atlas I did with Beth and Thomas, published earlier this year, called People and Places. It looks at 2011 and 2001 census to see how things are changing. This is my most boring slide, but to show you we do actually do some work. The tedious part of this kind of work is spotting when ONS published something in 2013 telling you they made a mistake with their census tables about whether somebody is a home-based worker or a cyclist. This is the kind of thing you have to be aware of to be able to use what I'm about to show you. You also have to look at the map like this. This is a map of the south of the UK stretched by population. So you've got about 5 seconds to learn that map. That's where we are. And of course, you'll suddenly see that London is a lot of people. It isn't parochial to talk about London in terms of what happens to people in planning in the south of England. If you were to add Birmingham and Cambridge and Oxford and Bristol and Reading and Exeter to that, you're actually talking about what I'm going to talk about the majority of people in the south of England. This is where the cycling happens. The purple areas are where between 5 and 14.3% of commuters cycle. And the dark purple dot is Oxford in the middle. You can see the centre of London beginning to rival Oxford, and you can see Cambridge. And a few other places, Exeter's down there as well. But most of the south is coloured a very light purple, which is less than 2% of people commuting by cycle. So cycling is already most popular in the densest places. There's the league table. Cambridge is winning. You can forget the Isles of Scilly, really. Oxford is third, if you include the Isles of Scilly. But if you look lower down, you'll see London boroughs rapidly becoming like Oxford and Cambridge. The big change over time is cycling having gone from being a working class pursuit. When I was growing up in Oxford, I used to have to wait sometimes 5 minutes to cross the road to get to school because of the mass ranks of the men cycling from the Bath and the State to the Cowley car factory, because the men who made cars in the 1970s could not actually afford to buy the cars they made. I had a flashback a few years ago, just around the corner on Whitehall, where again I had to wait for a couple of minutes one morning because of the mass ranks of civil servants. Cycling has changed in social class. Here's the change in 10 years of the proportion of commuters cycling in the south of England. And what only a census can tell you is that in most of the south, which is coloured orange, you're seeing falls in cycling. And particular falls in the parks actually voted most for Leeds, incidentally, for that. Probably that's the last thing I'll say about it. And increases in Oxford, increasing in Cambridge, increases in Bristol, and of course increases in London. But we're actually facing declines in cycling. We think we're facing increased cycling because we live, those of us who talk about these things the most, will get allowed to talk about them most, we live in London and we live in Oxford. And overall the census shows a slight increase, but that increase is entirely accounted for those areas that are coloured purple on these maps. Because for many people, cycling is what you do until you can afford the car, or until you can afford the second car. There's a change over time, and if we just take Oxford, you can see we've just had a 1.2% rise in people cycling. We've had a 1.2% rise in people walking. That adds up to 2.4%. which nicely balances the declining car use. So it's slowly cycling the pace like Oxford's increasing, but not in most of the south of the country. Let's quickly show you the north. That's what the north of the UK looks like at the moment, with barely a proportion of the population. This is where people cycle the most, and essentially that city is York. Again, medieval city, medieval road system. The other city with a high proportion is Edinburgh at the top, and near York, Hull, but Hull's falling. Hull's very flat. And there's some blurb just giving you some numbers saying it really is going down. And some statistics if you really want to know. But what's more dramatic than the statistics is just that everywhere in the north, fewer people are cycling by 2011 as compared to 2001. So we're not facing a general cycling euphoria. You're not going to get people on their bikes unless you make it easier and safer to cycle. One reason why you're not seeing an increase in cycling is that many people no longer cycle as children. And the reason they don't cycle as children is because their parents are very scared for them. And their parents are right to be scared for them, because the most common way in which somebody from the age of 5 to 25 dies in Britain now is by being hit by a car. The reason it's the most common way in which they die is because the other ways in which people used to die, childhood leukemia, infectious diseases, various other cancers, have all been made dramatically less deadly. So you're left with cars as the thing you should worry about the most. Parents will always worry about their children, it's inbuilt. So you can't tell them not to worry about the greatest threat, and if you don't cycle as a child, cycling later on as an adult is difficult, even in Oxford. There's a few more stats, there aren't many more of these, don't worry, people who like stats. But just to show you the overall pattern, which I don't think is appreciated. In Oxford, this time of year, you see many 18-year-olds getting on a bike for the first time. Many 18-year-olds from all around the world. Some of them from other countries in the world have been on a bike before. The reason we know that is that they cycle on the right-hand side of the road. It takes them about 4 weeks. So this is the most dangerous time of year in Oxford for cycling. So what's the plan? I learned a few minutes ago that this may no longer be the plan, but this is Oxfordshire's county plan as of 2015, connecting Oxfordshire local transport plan. And here's the text on this, and I'm going to carry on quoting this until I die. And if I'm lucky, and I'm feeling confident given my blood pressure and everything else I've learned about today, you know, this could be 20, 30 years of quoting this plan. I don't care if they're rewriting it. They said visionary cities such as Copenhagen and Amsterdam have led the way by showing that cycling is the solution to 21st century travel problems. That's up the County of Oxfordshire plan. And of course there are more ambitious things in London, some of which have been implemented, but not that much compared to other cities in Europe. And there's a picture in the plan. That's a picture of rural cycling in the future in Oxfordshire. And again, this applies to London. London is surrounded by a greenbelt. We might argue a bit later about the greenbelt, but what is the point of having a greenbelt, particularly a greenbelt that's so unbiodiverse as the one we've got, if you can't actually get out and into it? And to get into it, unless you're going to drive there, you need something like this. Except you need something much better than that if you've ever cycled, because that surface is absolutely awful to cycle on. I'll get to that a bit later. Here's the detail. We're going to have, by 2015-16 financial year, so that's past, one cycle premium route. And the cycle premium route is going to be safe, direct, and well signposted. Page 6 of the county report. County report starts with loads and loads of stuff about bikes. Then a bit about buses, and as I'll show you towards the end of something about cars, which was this thing I think Oxfordshire County is actually really interested in. It just at least has learned that people don't want me to talk about cars. Then we're going to have another 3 cycle premium routes by 2016-17. So that's, we've got until April. There's no sign, as far as I know, of these. I'm sure somebody will say, actually, there is going to be one to the science park or something. And some more by 28. 7 routes in total by April 28. My bugbear, anybody, I'm not a particularly keen cyclist. I only cycle because it's stupid for me not to already. And that will be the main reason most people will start cycling in the future, and it does become so obvious that this is how you get to a train station, it's how you get to work, it's how you get around. That, for anybody who cycles from Oxford train station to the centre of town, the main route, that's the little zone of death they built for you in the middle. It's not great. I suppose it's better than... maybe better than before. Cambridge is just as bad. If you've ever cycled from Cambridge Station into Cambridge, just watch the buses pushing. Yeah, we will tell these stories in future and people won't believe us. So here's my suggestions. But again, think about another borough. Think about another town. I'm only doing it from Oxford because I know Oxford. I grew up there. I know Oxford from the point of view of somebody without a car, because like all children in Oxford, I didn't drive a car. You've got to remember, there's a whole set of people who legally cannot drive cars. Some of my friends did drive cars a bit later, somewhat dangerously. But children are good at not driving cars. Many elderly people can't drive cars. Cars don't make sense. This map is by Richard Mann. If you've got very good eyesight, you can see the blue lines, which are the recommended cycle routes for Oxford, which are the slightly less dangerous paths to take. But interesting that it had to be produced by an interested amateur rather than the city itself saying these are our cycle routes. In one of Britain's most famous cities for cycling, they're the blue ones. But where would you put the cycle premium routes? I've made these suggestions in Oxford and I'm going to make them again and again. They received various reactions. Cycle geeks love them. Extreme cycle geeks love them, I should say. In general, they're agreed with guffaws of that'll never happen. The reason I think that they will happen, there's a little road in the very middle, there's a cross which means that Carfax, the crossroads of Oxford, there's a little old road called Coalmarket that goes north of there, and when I was very small they had cars on it. And then they got rid of the cars, and they had buses. And then Margaret Thatcher said competition was great, and got lots of bus companies. But the buses actually ground to a halt on Coalmarket. And then we worked out to stop them competing on that road and had only one bus company allowed on it. But even that was too much. And so I come back to Oxford 3 years ago and I find it's pedestrianised. If you had said when I was a child that Coalmarket would be pedestrianised, the main thoroughfare of the city, people would have said you're mad. So I'm hoping somebody will say I'm mad now. Because I do think that the biggest changes that you get that really happen are things which are seen as ridiculous at the time they're presented. So this is where I put the cycle premium routes. This first one is the main road out to London. It's called London Road. I cycled on it for years because my school was on that road. And I would have four lanes for bikes. Two lanes going one way, two lanes going the other way. Allows you to overtake bikes safely. And just one lane for motorised vehicles that goes out to London. That's why it's called London Road. And if you're trying to get to somewhere on the London Road with a vehicle, you're going to have to go around that way, which might take you longer than it would have taken you before. Currently, when you get two buses on the London Road, they go quite fast. They're supposed to only go 30 miles an hour, but on the timetable to get to London, you're squeezed out if you're on a bike. It's not a safe road. One reason for suggesting this is it's cheap. It's not free. There's lots of bits of street furniture you have to move, and white paint isn't cheap, and everything else isn't cheap. But compared to anything else you might do, taking your existing roads, making arterial roads, making them one way for motorised traffic, I think has to be the cheapest thing that you can do. Second road is the Iffy Road. And if you have an Iffy Road only coming in, you'll begin to see you've got the loop going around. Then the Abingdon Road goes down to Abingdon. I've got a very simple scheme. Iffley is in Oxford, so we'll get it in. Botley Road in Oxford goes that way. And the really obvious pair are the Woodstock and Banbury Road. And they're going to happen. They will happen at some point. It's just too obvious. But take those main arterial roads, make them one way, halve the amount of space for buses and cars. Lots of arguments about whether you should let buses sneak very slowly the other way as well. I don't really mind how you get here. I just want some people to think about getting here. I think this is where we'll be in 40 years' time, and perhaps if we thought about it, we might be there in less than 40 years' time. Finally, the Cowley Road, the ever so slightly bohemian road in Oxford, that our students think is really exciting. And because they think it's really exciting, this is the students from Brooks and the university, and quite a lot of the officers of the city, that's where they go to mill about and drink. At night. It's got loads of traffic coming on, but it really is really, really, really dangerous to cycle on it. I cycle on it at least twice a week. It's absolutely deadly. For the Cowley Road, I'll show you in a minute what you do, but essentially you cut it off at 3 points so that nobody in their right mind is trying to cycle the way in or out along it, but you can still get everywhere if you need to by virtualised transport. Because whatever you do, everywhere has to be accessible. Because people have luggage, some people can't cycle, some people like using the bus, it all has to be accessible. It doesn't have to be as accessible as it is at the moment, to as much detriment to everybody who's not in a car at the moment. I didn't get this idea from my own little imagination. I got it from living in the city of Sheffield for 10 years before I came to Oxford. And this is the middle of Sheffield, and Sheffield already has it. The trick is not to draw your lines really big and thick, but to make little blue lines, arrows, very small. So if you look, you can just see them. It's exactly the same effect. And there's little black lines across the roads. If you look, that's a gate. That means you can't go that way by car. That's the only Sheffield I ever knew. I went, I thought it was normal. It took me about a year to work out. If you go into Sheffield to the ring road, no matter how you go in, you've got to come back out the same way. Which means you only go in if you're picking something up heavy to go out. You don't cut through the middle of the town because it's quicker than going around the ring road. Oxford built a ring road a long time ago when people knew more about cycling, so it has a cycle track on it. Unfortunately, the cycle track that has had nothing done to it since it was built. The ring road was built to try to stop people going through the middle of the city. There's the less frightening map of Oxford, showing what would happen. But why? Now, it's not just houses. The John Radcliffe Hospital is here. I think it's Europe's biggest hospital. It's absolutely enormous. And you can look out from it and you can see these fields. Just to really rub it home, if you work in that hospital, that it will be so easy to give you somewhere to live where you could walk or cycle to work. And maybe think about working there for 3 years or 5 years or 10 years or 15 years. But of course those fields are in the Greenbelt. Where Spartan's being built, there's a whole area that isn't being built. And there are several good reasons for not going into a Greenbelt. One is, there's a great danger that when that Greenbelt is breached, it'll be breached by a developer who will build houses that's only just attached. They've got 4 bedrooms, not very big 4 bedrooms, double garage, and it'll be filled up around Oxford by people who want access to that road to drive to London. So you only want to breach the Greenbelt when you're going to breach it with some decent planning, which is not about maximising the profit. The other thing you want to try to do is to prevent sprawl. So how do you prevent sprawl? You only breach the Greenbelt in a way where the dominant mode of transport is a bike, because there's a limit to how far most people are prepared to cycle. And thirdly, you actually build some cycle tracks into the countryside, where the point of them is that they have fields either side, because it's quite nice to cycle past fields, and you protect your green belt by actually providing access to it. to give most people a reason to care about it, rather than the people whose house prices are being uplifted by the fact that they live in a little village in the Greenbelt. The Greenbelt really is not protected for the views. You really don't want to be on the fourth or fifth floor of an active hospital looking out. Nice views, but that's the place you can see them. Ruskin College and Oxford, you can see them. I grew up in that part of town, couldn't see them. Not protected for views. We have protected views into Oxford. We have seven of them, the Dream of Cream and Spires. Four of those views can't actually be seen at the moment because trees have grown up. You want to protect the Greenbelt for very good reasons, but it's not the Greenbelt we currently have. And if you're really going to protect the Greenbelt in future, you want to give people a good reason to value it, which is they can actually get into it and use it. So that's housing. There's other reasons to think about cycling. Oxford doesn't just have a housing crisis. Housing compared to average wages is higher than in London. I think about 16 times average wages in London. I was told this morning about how it's better off getting a job in London because you get London waiting on the NHS and not Oxford waiting, unless you're a radiologist grade 6. The amount I know now about the pay structure of the NHS is far too much. Oxford has a huge housing crisis, the worst in the country. We have homeless people now with all their belongings for the first time next to London on the streets. But we also have an education crisis in Oxford. I think we have the biggest educational divides of any city in Europe. I challenge anybody to show me another city with schools that produce such different results in such a small area. And this is somewhat embarrassing for a city of education. London's kind of been saved by this, by immigration. Immigration is the main reason why London comprehensively so well. London Challenge helped. Having a partner working in finance as a teacher helped. Manages to keep teachers in London. Places like Oxford don't have that. That's the Oxford Academy, where 28% of children get five GCSEs, A star to C each year. Just a few go to university. Average age of teachers, by eyeballing it, is under 25. I'm going around. Constant turnover. Lovely building, but the best building of any school in Oxford. Friendly building, the entire middle class shunned that school. The Catholic school, minority of children get that basic pass, and it's there. The old boys' grammar school, 58%. Cheney, it says no change because that's the first of these schools not to have to change its name from what the school was called when I was growing up. It's a bit like Liverpool Riverside and Toxic and Windscale and Sellafield. Right? There's a rule in Britain. If your name gets associated with something bad, just change it, it'll be okay. All that happens 30 years later is you're back when you started. That's the Tatler recommended state school of Charwell. With only a 72% pass rate, and little dots if you're interested, we need a new secondary school. But of course, we don't have any planning now. All our secondaries are academies in the county. Toby Young came along and offered to give us a free school. Luckily, somebody else came up with a free school. The school was supposed to be starting in September, in 11 months' time, and yet there is no site, let alone anybody building anything. So it is a very, very fast building. That's what happens if you get into planning. And in a way, it's quite interesting because the market is going to damage fairly well-off people first. Now, why I put the schools up is it's very hard to think what you can do about the schools if people say they really don't like cycling around Oxford. And most people don't. We've got the numbers up, but it's low. And they certainly don't want children cycling, apart from a few safe routes. I'll give you an example of what you could do. And part of this is what you do in times of austerity. An extreme example is you could return the Oxford Academy to being the county grammar school, which is what it was at the time of my birth. And then the children of North Oxford, of course, with passive M plus with all their coaching and tutors, would have to cycle all the way from the top of the city down if they wanted to go to grammar. And that may be one of the fastest ways to get safety and freedom in the city, but I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think we're going to get the grammar. The kind of thing you do in times of austerity, just as you would change arterial roads into one way, because that's the cheapest you can do, is you would think about sharing teachers. Say between Cheney and Spires, they're really near. Share teachers. And occasionally move pupils. Why not do all the chemistry on just one side rather than try to maintain two chemistry labs? Now I'll let you begin to take this further in your own mind. It sounds utopic, but we already have 800 cooperative schools in Britain where you cooperate with other schools rather than compete with them. You always use the same sites. Whenever we change education in this country, it's actually the same buildings and the same sites. But we suddenly use free education for all with the Butler Act, and then we introduced comprehensives in the late 60s, but mostly in the 70s, on the same sites. You use the same sites, but you begin to share the teaching staff, you begin to move the pupils around, and then suddenly the £100,000 house price jump between each of those catchments doesn't make any sense. I can guess who's going to oppose this. If you spent an extra £400,000 on a house because it's in a certain catchment, you might be a bit annoyed. But again, just coming from Sheffield, Sheffield has six comprehensives that did better than Oxford's two because it didn't have private schools. A third of 15 years ago, private in Oxford. I'm only picking on Magdalen College. 0% means they don't take GCSEs. They have their own special exams they do at 15, 16. But the reason for putting Magdalen College there is it's a hub school. It's actually the educational site at the centre of the city. So eventually you need partnership with the private school in the middle if you're going to move children and teachers around. But currently that kind of thing sounds impossible and ridiculous, but you do get real change over decades. Things really do change. Recently the university's been told, actually hasn't been told, it's kind of indicated by things government say, they'd be really good if we could sponsor a school. What government ministers don't realise, which is quite a shock given how many of them actually come from Oxford, including our Prime Minister, is we already do sponsor a school. It's just a school that's now rather an elite private school. But when we first sponsored it, it was a school for those who were too poor to have a governess. So we have a history of them sponsoring schools. Enough about schools. But I'm just trying to get through the idea. I'm not talking about bikes because I love bikes. I'm talking about bikes because I can't see how you can make progress with housing and education unless you make progress with transport. To begin to change things that we do in this country, which most of the rest of Europe doesn't do. That's a much neater version of this little plan that's put up to propose people. So on all those roads with a red arrow, you have two lanes of cycles going one way, cars and buses just going one way, two lanes of cycles going the other way, or you can have a motorised buggy. You don't have to do your motorised buggy on the pavement. The barriers on the county road are just there, which let you get everywhere but not particularly high. And then the interesting thing is the green arrows outside. Because almost nobody, apart from a few middle-aged, lightly clad men, cycle down to Oxford. So what are you doing having a city full of people with bikes if they don't cycle out? They don't cycle out because they're not having a midlife crisis. And they realise how dangerous it is to cycle out of Oxford onto on our roads. So here's some suggestions about cycling out. I'll show you them in more detail in a minute. Back to that county plan. Hidden in the back of it, I think page 43 or later, is a suggestion about what to do with roads. And this is where you see what the plan really is. You can only just see it. Who can actually see the light cyan blue dashed line? Put your hands up and you can see that line. Good, some of the back, you can eyesight test. It's just here. See that one? One just here. Blue road. Big road. That's what somebody really wants. There's still this level of roads. Things have changed. So the bit about roads is hidden at the back. All the promises about bikes are made at the front. The promises about bikes are not kept. a bit about the boat. Well, Andrew Adonis has his infrastructure fund, doesn't he? I partly don't mind this too much because of my sceptical anarchist background, which says if you are going to build new dual carriageways anywhere, please build them in Oxfordshire, because it's so much easier for road protesters to get to them than it would be when the M11 was extended or the Luby bypass was built. That was a right drag to get down. This way you can camp in George Hornblower's home. You know, he'll make you a cup of coffee, tell you how he did it his day. Very simple with fracking, by the way. What's going to stop fracking is the cost of fracking and the cost of moving the protesters. Grandmothers in Lancashire. What stopped us building roads like this for years is people factoring in the cost, the policing cost. Back to the county plan about the cycle superloops. So I showed you what's really going to happen, or was planned to happen. But the county made promises that we're going to have these superloops going out. But no mention in the plan about where they might be. It says they should be safe, direct, and well signposted. But the way to do that is to have them off-road entirely. And to do them like this. These are the cycle routes you see across the Peak District. Now, it was relatively easy in the Peak District because there were railways, beautifully flat. So tarmacking the railways and letting people cycle. This one actually is a cycle around the dam. The dam is also nice and flat. But Oxfordshire's not that hip, so you could have routes into the countryside. I've forgotten how many dozens Copenhagen has and Amsterdam has and so on, or Freiburg has. No, this isn't making this up. This is my suggestion about where you might want to put them. And they're away from the boats. And then you protect the area near the cycle from building because you want it to be green. So it protects the green belt. There's a little airport here. Somebody's currently bidding to buy it, I think, and wants to build tens of thousands of houses. Or tens of thousands. If they do that, wouldn't it be great if some of them could actually get in that way? It's possible. It's possible if we become more European, and now you may become more less prejudiced about my view. If we instead become more American, forget all of this. I'll end in about 5 minutes if you're finding all this too much. The extreme American view comes from Texas, which was a mayor of a city in Texas who was opposed to the building of pavements because pavements are the road to communism. But most Americans are far better than that. But there is the politics of transport, which is individualised is good. Shared collective space, going slower, but worrying about the common good is bad. And that's going to affect how we develop our towns and cities in the future. And if you go to the individualistic model, you'll build more roads, a few people will have more cars than bigger cars, and two sets of garages, and most people will be struggling, and the John Radcliffe Hospital will take far more than 10 hours to process somebody who's only cut his lip in 20 years' time. Or you can look forward 105 years. This is an advert for a book that was published last week. I've never met the author. It's called Ecotopia 2121. Beautiful book. It's only about £20. Worth getting somebody for Christmas. It goes to 100 cities in the world suggesting what they might be like in 2021. 2121. 2121 is far enough away that you know it's going to be different. Because you go back that far in time, of course it's different. If you go back 100 years, imagine telling somebody 100 years ago that the docks of London would now have banks on them. They wouldn't believe you. Or the government ministers would be arguing about just which airport they were going to expand. They'd ask you, what's an airport? So of course, 2121 is going to be different. The reason for putting it up is completely predictably, the city of Oxford does appear in it as one of the 100, and it's a cycle-free city. I haven't even talked about the middle of the city. I haven't yet talked about the huge potential for increased tourism in Oxford. Not really potential, an inevitability. The world's middle class is exploding in number. When you become truly middle class, you travel. A bit like the way some of you have in the past. And after you've done London and Paris, and New York, and LA, you need somewhere else to go. And then you go to Oxford. Oxford's already full of tourists. So again, unless you get the cars out and get bikes in, unless you get tourists on bikes and move them away, unless you give every Oxford college a sorting hat and its own wizard, so they don't all go to Christchurch, you're not going to cope with the tourists you're going to get in future, and they're not going to have a happy experience. If the tourists have a happy experience and you get more from in Oxford, you can sell them free teas, you can sell them all kinds of things. And then you don't have to take money from men from Russia who are worried about their reputation. As far as I go, and I get myself in trouble. It's utopic, but it's just so much better than where we've been. And it's also practical. I don't think it's hard to argue that there'll be more tourists. I don't think you can do the Windsor model for Oxford. You know, just tourism, just one old school, two train stations, and we're fossilising. Okay, it's a Queen's house, that's fine. Oxford's the biggest city between Birmingham and London. You can't do the same thing with it. Here's the reason why there's a greenbelt around Oxford. There's this map. It isn't really this map, it's the people who managed to get this map drawn, which are the people who work in the places that I now work, who really didn't like the car factory that came in the 1930s. You've got to guess what the hashed red area is around, which is greenbelt, and why they were hashing it red. And the reason was that it was land with a high water table, which wasn't true for most of it, that's just a little valley, broken ground, and areas which cannot economically be supplied with sewage, water, electricity or gas. That's the reason given for Oxford's incredibly tight greenbelt. It wouldn't be economical to supply it with electricity, sewage and gas. It's completely bogus, but you don't want a sporting city, you do want a green city. 2 minutes, let's give you this quickly then. Just to show you how different things are. We did try this very briefly in Britain, but we're such a car culture, we tried it for a few years and got rid of it, we entered it in a very muted way. Other countries in Europe have speeding fines proportional to your income. So somebody in Finland in 2013 was fined a good of £80,000 for speeding. Not speeding that fast, just he had a lot of money. A man did drive a car through Switzerland at 85 miles an hour, I think three times through a village, particularly provocative in his Ferrari. He was fined £180,000 for doing that in Switzerland. But my favourite is the footballer who was fined €540,000 simply for driving without a licence. If you want to see how strange our attitude to cars is compared to the rest of Europe, just think why we let people speed on our country roads and they don't. And what it might take for us to stop doing that. Two more slides. I need to say thanks to a series of cyclists, Robin Tucker, Kevin Hillman, Jim McDonald, Simon Hunt, Terry and Don, the Civic Society, and David, who's here, for commenting on these ideas. I'm doing this talk in London because Oxford itself is not going to sort it out that fast. We need a national government that actually says it wants some more housing in the areas that need housing. It wants housing for elderly people, which will help them get out of their large family houses, but not move too far away because they don't want to. And there has to be direction from national government. Oxford City and Oxford County are separate little entities. They cannot sort this out separately. That notice is from 1968 when I was born, when Oxford was called the City of Screaming Tyres, asking the young men, the largely young men, to be a bit more thoughtful about how they park their motor vehicles. Things really do change. And finally, here's the 1927 plan for the city. We're currently built up largely within the ring road. They got the flooded area wrong in 1927. It's wider than that, so you've got an actual green lung, a green belt within Oxford. And they propose building in those areas of the purple and around the edge which have not been built on. And it's a circle. Because they propose building in such a way that you could cycle from everywhere and you wouldn't build too far away to cycle. And we can see it in 1927. But people in the university hated the idea of Oxford becoming a normal little city, and they froze it. The wonderful thing about having frozen it is that Oxford, and the same applies to London with its green belt, could now go into the green belt in a way far better than would have happened. Far better planned, far less profit motive, far more green corridors than if we hadn't had the green belt. We're only talking about 1% of the green belt. But the danger is, if you're completely opposed to the green belt, developers will get in and build inappropriate things for maximum profit in the green belt. If you say you can accept some breach of the green belt, but it has to be really carefully thought out and for the common good rather than to maximise profit, at the very least, that will stop people building something inappropriate because they can make a fast buck out of it. I've gone over my time. Thank you very much.
Does this split in responsibilities between the council and the city council cause problems, and should it be resolved in similar relationship with government departments?
Yes. The example is Cambridge and Cambridgeshire to see local authorities getting on better with each other. But they've done a bit more. But Cambridge only looks good because of Oxford doing badly. Cambridge doesn't look good compared to Freiburg and Amsterdam and Copenhagen. But Oxford has this historic enmity that will go. It's there because the city had 40,000 car workers, they were a solid red block. And the county was afraid that the whole county would turn red. The problems of county and city are now much more merged. The differences between the two are less. But it's a silly political boundary to have. Similarly, having separate departments interested in looking after, well, it's all going to shake up at the moment, but looking after agriculture and biodiversity and interested in transport and so on, doesn't allow you to break through and do the kind of things we did with new towns in the past. The new town legislation is there. So if you wanted, you could take new town legislation and apply it around a city like Oxford or in parts of London. And that would take you out of the control of the government departments and less blocking for the current split. My reason for hesitation is I like local accountability. It's just at the moment we have four rural districts who largely want very little to happen on the edge of Oxford and something to happen in their bits. And the city utterly constrained. But again, it'll be similar to London boroughs and the edge of London. If you're trying to get older people to move to flats but can still see their friends and their family, some of those flats are going to have to be in the London Greenbelt to achieve that. And that's the biggest block on housing, is the success of our elderly population living into their 80s and sometimes 90s, and the lack of suitable accommodation for them to move to. What will help is if and when house prices begin to fall, which they may be doing in London. But you still need something to move to. Once your family house is falling in value, the faster you sell up and get out of it, the more money you make. So eventually, London won't carry on rising in price forever. But we don't have the accommodation for people to move into. So in the case of Oxford, I would like to see quite a lot of this on the edge actually being apartments with views for the elderly. And again, I'm copying ideas from elsewhere. If you go to Basel in Switzerland, in the middle of Basel, which is the city as pretty as Oxford, there's a tower block. And the tower block houses the very, very elderly who can sit there in their flats looking at this beautiful city And the people look at the tower block and they don't see it as ugly. They see it as, oh yes, that's the tower block for the very elderly people who like to see mountains in the city. Wouldn't put a tower block in Oxford, but five-storey apartments on the hills on the outside, just so somebody can actually see these gleaming spires. Because it's almost impossible to find somewhere to see them from.
That was the most fascinating and wonderful expose of what could be done. And looking at that plan at the end, it sort of takes me back to almost Ebenezer Howard type thoughts of what could be done to be able to create a fantastic new garden city with Oxford as its incomparable hub, if you like, which would then also enable all sorts of your ideas of breaking down traffic, the problems of cars and other vehicles and bikes. It would enable all sorts of things to happen, perhaps a major congestion charge on the centre of the city. So everyone would be really put at some cost to bring their cars into the centre of the city. At the moment, we have government exploring the idea of new garden cities. I'm just thinking how fascinating it would be to see how one could actually come up with an idea that would recreate, but a better vision now, properly master plan, of what could and should have been done in 1927 when it was thought. Do you think that is something that is possible?
It's been half done already, but kind of done with subterfuge. So the Wolfson Prize last year, 2 years ago, it's called Uxbridge. It's actually York turned upside down. All you've got to do is turn the map upside down and nobody knows where it is. It's York turned upside down, some expansion turned upside down, some more garden city suburbs on the outside. And what nobody noticed, I think, with Wolfson, and it may be, you know, Wolfson is, he's not a socialist, he's Lord Wolfson. In Balanced Books, that was me. What the Wolfson Prize winners put in their proposal wasn't just that, it was actually open access to the countryside, almost like the right to roam in country parks. So you've got somewhere to go. Now, I haven't said anything about that because that really is hard. If you know who owns the estates in Oxfordshire and the 2,000 lakes you cannot see, let alone swim in, then. But if you have an aspiration that at some point in the future you'll have the right to roam, you will have people living with very low carbon consumption, with short commutes, with low cost housing compared to what we have, just like in other parts of Europe. Just having that as an aspiration makes it so much easier when you're arguing about this little area down there called Grenoble Road. When you're arguing about moving towards that, if you don't have that as an aspiration, you've got no chance. And what I find sad is, it's not just the rest of Europe that has this. Again, South Yorkshire, here's the Peak District National Park. Okay, the rambles did go up and get shot by gamekeepers to get it. You know, but even within England, people elsewhere have what people in the south of England don't have. They have access to the countryside, which is not just driving to a town and using the tea shop, and not just a few footpaths. Often, in the case of Oxford on Moors Hill, with 8-foot-high fences built either side of the footpath to ensure that nobody walks down it by the landowners either side. If that still exists when I have grandchildren, we really will have failed. And we've gone backwards.
Yeah.
Thank you. Being a cyclist, I applaud your vision there. I noticed that the robotics department in Oxford University is doing a lot of work around autonomous vehicles. What thoughts have you given to the future of autonomous vehicles being involved in your plan?
I thought about them a little bit. I've forgotten the name of the... I'm not a transport expert, so it's kind of obvious to everybody who is. I'm interested in inequality and futures of cities. Google are also very interested in these, of course. Somebody will tell me later who the expert is, but he said the problem with autonomous vehicle is that it's almost goading children to throw a ball in front of it because it has to stop. So I think there are unforeseen problems with autonomous vehicles. We shouldn't be driving cars. We haven't evolved to drive a ton of steel and glass at 30 miles an hour. We can't do it. There are some lovely graphics that show people driving a car next to a cliff, which of course is as dangerous as driving a car next to an oncoming car. You've all learned to be scared of cliffs through generations and generations of your forebears who weren't scared not reproducing. That's why we're scared of heights. The amount of generations it will require to evolve to be scared of cars is too bad. And the reason for saying that is, in general, we shouldn't be driving cars. It doesn't make any sense. They're a very short-term thing. A computer driving a car should be safer than a human being, but it's still not that safe for the pedestrians crossing. And the logic of a ton of fastened steel. If you want to see part of the future, I mentioned Europe a lot. Japan has had declining car usage every year for 20 years. And in Japan, you only own a car if you live in rural areas. In the cities, you travel by train, then slower train, then sort of tram-like thing. And you might use a taxi for the last bit of the journey if you've got very heavy bags. But otherwise, you walk. Because what I've mentioned so far is that we also been devolved to spend our lives sitting, like you've just been sitting down. And what a car ultimately does is make you sit very still for a long amount of time. Very, very bad for you compared to walking and cycling. You need to begin to factor in those arguments as well. And if you're being skeptical about this, in the Netherlands, 50% of pensioners cycle. In the UK, it's just 1% of pensioners. People often think, well, you can't make people cycle more, make it so easy for cyclists. It wouldn't be fair on pensioners. It's much fairer for pensioners to have a cycle culture where they're far less likely to be hit, because after children, they're the most vulnerable group to get older, than it is to have a virtualized vehicle culture.
We're talking 10 years. Have you given a thought of how to reduce the necessity of commuting?
December is the 500th anniversary of Thomas More's Utopia. So there's still time to celebrate. It's great being able to not commute. My wife is a civil servant in National England, like most government departments in National England have very, very big cuts. And sensibly, they cut their buildings before they cut their people. So there's hardly any offices left. Almost everybody works from home, and it's possible to do it. They also have the greenest budget of any government department. They are National England. Do kill badges as well. But it works. You get a bit lonely. So that works. People will still need to move around a bit and head spy. The one we really want to curtail is the very important moving. I do this, so I'm fixing it myself. Going to that very important international meeting because you must be there. Yeah. The scope we could do to reduce pollution and what will happen to people around Heathrow by explaining that very often international travel is for narcissistic reasons rather than being necessary is huge. But local travel does help keep you sane, and actually meeting people is useful. There's a lovely article in The Economist a few years ago about all the health problems caused by frequent flying. It's amazing. And these people who fly frequently, just look at them. Look at the bodies of leading business people. I won't name any of them to avoid any rival. The one with the highest salary in Britain is what I always think of. But it goes through what happens to your face, how it ages you. Let alone deep vein thrombosis and mental health problems. So working from home, far less international travel, but some scope to meet, and to be in a place like this, hopefully if you haven't come from too far, and I'll chat with people, because you can't do everything through a screen. We are made to interact, but very good at seeing each other's eyes. And we can just about see our eyes, but it's through faces that we react. I used to do maps a long time ago where I drew faces. Each area is a face. The face was happy if it had jobs and sad if it didn't. And the eyes were big if it had young industry, and small with a giant forehead if it was old. I looked around the moves. Giant forehead, of course, means clever as well. And these maps I thought worked because we were very good at seeing faces with the sign to do it. We're the only primate who actually has white around their eyes, which means you can actually see who's looking at you, which makes somebody like me acutely aware of who's nodded off, whether they're smiling or not. And that doesn't work so well on the screen.
Yeah.
You've argued about the areas outside of Oxford being developed for the greater good and not for maximum profit. For that to happen, do you see a renewed push on social building? How would that be?
I think you do need something like a new town authority that actually has the authority to stop the market winning. And then different things are possible. I like the idea of social housing. I just wouldn't do council housing again. So one thing that worries me about progressive politics is that it's often about defending the 70s. So you have to defend comprehensive schools, defend council housing, so not as bad as the fame of going back to grammar schools, which is going back to the 50s. But it's not that forward thinking. But there was a time when we campaigned for things we didn't have. So somebody had to campaign to get free education for, somebody had to campaign for our children to be in the same school, somebody had to campaign to get social housing. I am very sceptical of some of the wackier schemes of co-building and the rest of it. But Lilac in Leeds has worked, and Lilac was a bond offer. If any of you got any money and feeling generous, the bond offer lasted until December. Lilac is Britain's, I think, most successful alternative housing scheme. They need to raise £100,000 by December. The Movement for Social Change, which I call the Committee of the Rich, will match it with another £100,000 to build across Leeds. And that's co-owned communal housing. I would have various types of these, but still, your local authority housing, we've done better to a high quality. I worry about housing associations that have become businesses. They vary dramatically in ethos, housing associations. Some are absolutely brilliant, others are essentially giant private landlords who prevail and have charitable status. But councils can do a very bad job as well. The more important thing, I've written a book called All That Is Solid About Housing about 3 years ago. I think the key thing to improve social housing is to give people the right to sell, which is opposite to the right to buy. And I keep the right to buy, because some people really, really want to own their house and do it up. I keep that. The right to sell is, if you decide you want to become a tenant, because interest rates rise to defend the pound, or whatever else happens, and you don't want to move, and you want your children to get to the same school, you have the right that your bank agrees to sell the interest on the house you're paying a mortgage on, to a housing association or the council, you become a tenant. That way, you suddenly get social housing on streets that are fully owner-occupied. And then, why would you pay £800,000 for a little BQ house in North Oxford if next door could become social housing? Because the prime element of location, location, location in Britain is how many metres are you away from the nearest council. If next door can become a council house, you've helped reduce the speculation in housing. But this all requires arguing for what you want. There is a place for the profit-making sector, but not just such a dominant place. And the problem is, because it's looking so hard for returns, it's so hard to find returns on money at the moment. That's why there's been a boom in London, because there's nowhere else in the world you can put money. So you can put it in London property, which is great and safe because it's in pounds, and pounds never fall in value. We do have to recognise that you have to control the private market in housing more than you've had to before, because of the temptation to try to make them eternal. So there are other ways of making them eternal for them.
Right, we actually have a drinks reception now to go to. Everybody who has a badge, don't take your badge away. You need your badge to get in over a minute away over in the RICS building. So I'm sure some of you went over there earlier. So please come along to that. And could you please join me in thanking Danny for just a brilliant lecture.